Hello and welcome to the After After Show Show, the part after the show show where we talk after about the show. I'm never going to nail that, and that's fine. That's a bit now. We're adding a new bit to the rotation.
Oh, goody.
What have you guys got going on? Because if no one says anything, I'm just going to talk about The Evil Dead 2 more.
Okay, quick, red, something. No.
Twilight Zone. No, yeah. Fuck.
I also watched...
Something who's watched. Spider-Man.
I've been doing a lot of Spider-Man stuff.
Yeah, the subject of Evil Dead and Sam Raimi and that one
even
guy.
Much of a spoiler because the time of upload, the video is going to go live in 2 days. I need to finish it first. It's a long one. It currently is sitting at just over 2 hours, so hopefully I can get it to just under 2 hours. Jesus Christ.
Man.
But I watched a whole bunch of stuff. I got to watch the old Spider-Man cartoon from the 90s. I got to rewatch all three of the Raimi movies. Become a heretic, fully a heretic about that. Stay tuned for more on that. Red was very displeased.
Yeah.
Then I also got to watch a bunch of Spectacular Spider-Man, which is honestly the best interpretation of Spider-Man so far until the new game comes out on the 20th.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun. I've been meaning to watch the little stretch of episodes you mentioned from the 90s one because it does look very fun. It's just I've been doing a completely unrelated nerd homework for the last few days. And and on a different end, I've been looking up different 90s stuff for a Trope Talk I've been getting footage for about a kind of weird subject, but part of what I wanted to explore was the disparity between like early anime dubs and the sub stories that they were adapting, because a lot of them were like, we gotta censor this for a Saturday morning time slot. I can't believe what they're letting them get away with over in Japan. And it's so funny. It's so funny every time because the end result is so much worse. Obviously, it's like you take a dramatic moment where like a character dies and then you're like, but nobody's allowed to acknowledge that they're dead. And it's like, cool. I guess all the pathos just drains out of the plot. It's just like, well, we're never going to see that guy again, but not because he's dead. He's on the hospital planet getting treated for his injuries, but we're never going to see him again.
It's a great proverbial farm upstate. The HFIL from Dragon Ball is hilarious.
Hipple is my favorite deep pull. I wonder how many people only know about it because they made jokes about it in Dragon Ball Abridged. But in the early like days of dubbing it, the like dubbing rights for Dragon Ball changed hands a few times. And for a couple of years, they were in the hands of Ocean Group, which was a Canadian voiceover company that also provided the voice work for Reboot. So if that Goku sounds familiar, or I guess more accurately, Bob sounds familiar. Anyway, so basically, they just dubbed it for a couple of years, and it was called the Ocean Dub or the Saban Dub, or, you know, because it doesn't have an official name. It's just like, yeah, this is when they did that. And that was the one where they were like, okay, we can have this badass shonen action anime thing going on, but nobody's allowed to die. So hopefully that doesn't fuck with the plot. And then they're like, you know what happens in episode 2, right? Goku dies. And they're like, no, he doesn't. That would be silly. He goes to the other world to train with King Kai, who is not God, even though that's what that means.
Okay. I know we've been talking about this for like 3 days at this point. I only just now realized that that's what happens in the second episode, is that Goku fucking dies. I truly thought he just went to another planet to train.
What?
I didn't realize that's what you were talking about. I thought there was some different thing that came later that I hadn't seen.
He has a halo for the entire training sequence.
I was confused. And nine.
Good God. Wow, but yeah, he gets a fucking hole blown in his chest by Piccolo. And then they're like, oh, he gets teleported away to another dimension, body and all, but he's for sure dead. And then they're like, oh, you gotta go along Snake Way to train with King Kai. And he's like, okay. And then he falls asleep and gets hit by a car and falls off into Hiffle.
Okay, listen.
Uh-huh.
I was very confused because they had to go through so many loops to justify what was happening. I just didn't understand what was happening. And then he wakes up on the planet and starts training. And I'm like, I guess he's doing this now.
Did you
the
watch?
Exact intended experience for the dub.
My
I was
God.
Nine and I had no fucking idea.
It's very unlikely that you watched the Ocean dub, but...
Whatever was on cable TV.
I guess that's wild and really funny. I mean, like, they did some censorship in at least, like, some of the dubs. I know they changed it for Kai when they were kind of like, all right, get all that shit out of here. We can make this good now. But there were a few things, like, when Nappa and Vegeta first land on Earth, the first thing Nappa does is, like, glass an entire city. He just, like, explodes it. And then somebody in the dub is like, boy, it's a good thing it was a Sunday and the city was empty. It's like, oh, yeah, one of those commuter cities. Nobody lives there. You just go there for work.
Wow.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm glad I learned something today.
Yes. But yes, in the ocean dub, they had to explain away the fact that Goku was hanging out with two large demons wearing tank tops that say hell on them. And they were like, all right, what's the minimal change that we can do to not make this a hugely annoying edit while still covering our asses? And they were like, okay, we just paint over this stroke here and this stroke here. Now he's in Hiffle, the home for infinite losers. And it's like, they didn't change anything else. Like, it was the fucking Wild West of dubbing. There was, like, no consistency. So you had these guys being like, yeah, no death allowed, but, like, we'll leave in the references to King Yama and Gauz and Mez, the underworld demons and stuff like that, and King Kai. And then you have 4Kids that's like, if we expose a single American child to an onigiri rice ball, they're going to explode! So,
man, 4Kids was on some other shit. Because we didn't have cable when I was growing up for a while. So, like, for a long, long time, my only access to non-PBS cartoons was 4Kids on Saturday mornings, baby. Get that full lineup. And just, like, I have so much nostalgia for that egregious level of dubbing and alterations. God. It makes me wonder about the shows that I didn't clock as being like, well, that's not a jelly donut, Brock. You and I, we're not fools here. Because, like, my favorite show on the network was Winx Club, which is an Italian cartoon originally, so it's been dubbed from Italian to English, and I don't know if they changed anything, if I'm being completely honest. I have no concept of whether or not that show is any different in the Italian.
I had a really weird experience with that, specifically with Winx Club, because I haven't watched very much of it, but I did pull a couple episodes to use as an example in an upcoming Trope Talk, and I'd seen some of them, like, just on my TV. They're available on one of the streaming sources I have, and then I went to get the footage, and I was like, this sounds worse.
The 4Kids dub is so much better.
That's
than
the thing.
The Nick one is by a long shot. It's one of the few shows they did better.
Yeah, well, the 4Kids voice actors were really good. Yeah. It's just like initially I thought I was losing it a little, and then I was like, no, hold on. Tech Girl did not have a British accent when I watched this show. What's going on here? And I looked it up and I was like, oh, okay. All right, cool.
All
it was a different dubbing company for a
in
second.
In the Nick dub sound exactly the same. And in the 4Kids dub, they had very distinct personality-filled voices. And, like, I don't really go back to the show. It was a childhood favorite. But, like, out of curiosity, I clicked through an episode before. And I'm like, this can live in my memory as, like, a perfect piece of something or other, because I cannot fathom. I think, like, a couple years ago I watched the first 3 seasons, like, in a night on YouTube, and the nostalgia hit was good, but man, I don't care for the Nick dub even a little bit. And they change it. The series has continued far beyond what I watched as a kid, and I, you know, the great great for,
like,
new kids who get
something
to watch it or whatever, but I'm like, I just like the part where it goes up until they graduate college, and everything after that is who knows.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I caught a few episodes of, like, the Yu-Gi-Oh! GX dub the other week.
Under duress.
Yeah, under duress. And the thing is, Magenta's watched Yu-Gi-Oh! GX subbed, and she was like, yeah, parts of it are really good. There's, like, this really, like, you know, obviously the main character is such a ray of sunshine, but they really put him through it, and just, like, the breakdown of all of his friends really starts to get to him, and he has this enshittening arc and is briefly a villain, but they do it badly. And I was like, yeah, that sounds pretty bad. And she was like, no, it could have been good, but they do it badly. And then we were watching it dubbed, and I was like, so how much of this is different? And she was like, well, first of all, every time they say someone would be sent to the stars, they're supposed to fucking die. So, you know,
Yu-Gi-Oh needs its shadow realm. It's just
but
a law.
But that's the thing. My first exposure to Yu-Gi-Oh, this is the only thing that saved me from this. My first exposure to Yu-Gi-Oh was the manga. My cousins had a couple volumes from Duelist Kingdom randomly, and the manga is dark. It started off as a horror manga, and it's good. It's really compelling. And then I would, like, catch the episodes, and it would be like, oh, Yugi boy, I'm afraid it's too late. You're going straight to the Shadow Realm, a realm of no consequence where bad things will implied to be happening to you. And it's like, where the fuck are all the guys with knives and tasers and shit like that was in the manga? Where are the guns? Why did you paint out the guns?
Remembering the line of, konnichiwa, everyone, and welcome to my Simply Sugoi tournament.
Oh my god, Maximilian Pegasus is the best character in any show.
I love him.
That's the Pegasus is supposed to die. Pegasus dies, but they keep, like, they glossed it over because Bakura fucking rips out his Millennium Eye, and then they're just, like, lugging his body away, and they're like, Mr. Pegasus is very sick. In anything that's canon, Pegasus never shows up again, but then, like, in GX, they're like, Pegasus is alive, and I'm like, GX is non-canon!
Right. Is there like a Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged that's available on YouTube?
Yes.
It is, in fact, the first and most well-known abridged series.
I am going to regret this. Can you send that to me?
Oh, no. I can try. It's been running a very long time. It got a lot better. It started off very funny when I was, you know, like 12.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Well, the thing is, it's been running for like basically like 12, 13 years, maybe more. It was kind of the progenitor of abridged series in their modern form. I don't know if it was the first one, but it was definitely very early, and it inspired a lot of imitators. Mm-hmm. There was a whole abridged series boom. Like, everyone and their grandmother was like, yeah, I can do an abridged series. I'm funny, and I like anime.
That's a joke they make in the Naruto abridged where the Hokage is like, and suddenly everybody wants to make a bridge.
Yeah, that is, in fact, the Naruto abridged you're thinking of made by Little Karibo, that's the same guy who did Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged.
Got it.
Yeah, that's
I'm
why
I'm surprised
he's like,
this hasn't come up before, because there was one summer in college where myself and a couple of other people, including some greens, got really into the Yu-Gi-Oh! Abridged for like a week. I think we just had a week where we had to sit in our dorm room straight, and I'm shocked because you were around that this is not warped its way into the blue sphere.
I still rewatch it every like couple years. It's just so fun.
I don't think I was like either present or cognizant of what was happening.
sorry, because we're talking about Duelist Kingdom. One of my favorite, like, one of the jokes that's really good, even though it's really early, is at one point when, like, Yugi and Pegasus are dueling, Tay is like, hold on, guys, I think something's happening. And it just cuts down. It's like, blah, blah, card games, blah, 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 attack mode, blah, 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 blah. Oh, my mistake. it's just... I don't know.
Damn it. That's really funny.
I just like fucking slammed back to like middle high school when I was getting into this.
It's so funny to it's so funny to me that like 4Kids felt the need to be like, no, we can't let them know that people die in Yu-Gi-Oh! Because people, all of the fairies have to die in season 3 of the Winx Club. It's like deeply tied into the plot, and they just do in the dub. So I don't know why they had such selective vision for it with any other series.
I think part of it was like, because they don't entirely censor out the threat of death. It sneaks through in a couple places. Like, there's of course, the iconic duel where Joey's been brainwashed by Merrick and Yugi must duel him. And they're like, you've been handcuffed to an anchor and it's
going to
fall into the ocean. Yeah, and it's like, oh, okay, and then we're going to die. That's the implied threat. Like, I don't think they say it, but it's like, yeah, there's no fucking way around that. But then, like, 2 episodes earlier, it's like, that's right, that dark energy disc will send your soul right to the Shadow Realm if it touches you. Ignore that it's shaped like a buzzsaw. And then you just watch the original, it's like, that's right, that buzzsaw is gonna slice your legs off if you lose this duel.
When I was younger, we had one GBA Yu-Gi-Oh! Game, the Sacred Cards, where you just play Battle City arc, but you have a self-insert character that they have superimposed into the game, and you build your own deck, and it's just like, oh, do all these characters, do all these cool duels that like Yugi or Joey did, and then they're not involved. Mm-hmm. But they don't censor any of the like the buzzsaw part of it or anything.
Yep.
So it feels crazy to me that they felt so, it was like, it was so important that in the dub we just not let the kids know that like saws exist, but this game that they could just buy at a GameStop at the same time for $10. Nothing's different. Everything is like the sub.
There's other stuff they censored too. It's really funny. Because, like, of course, as mentioned, the first thing I did was, like, read some of the Duelist Kingdom manga, which meant I met My Valentine in the manga, where she's like, now I equip my lovely harpies with cyber bondage armor. And I was like, neat, I'm 7. And then I see it in the anime, and I'm like, it looks different than I remember. Where'd the spikes on the nipples go? And I watch it subbed, and I'm like, there they are. It's just some poor person had to go through and paint them out. And, like, the harpy ladies are a recurring, like, threat. They show up a lot. It's
one
just
of
like,
the most iconic cards and decks of all time.
Yeah. And also, anytime someone's in like a little bikini, they have to like paint it to look more like a one piece like suit. They had to do so much paint over. Also, there's like an alarming tendency for like some of the characters in Yu-Gi-Oh! To end up like crucified a little bit, and they were like, well, we can't hide that they're, like, chained up, but we can hide that they're chained to a cross, so now it's a big rock. or, like, a kind of a wedge shape.
Now, here's the thing. I remember these changes. I was spared from the original. It worked exactly as intended.
Yeah, exactly. But also, most of the time, you probably wouldn't have been like, whoa, that's so weird for my child brain. Why is he on a cross and not a slab?
But otherwise, I'm trying to think of what I wanna contribute. I've been playing the new Assassin's Creed. My thoughts on it are as of yet incomplete. Mm. It's like, I'm gonna say it. It's fucking good, and yes. No one is more shocked than me. I am astounded and honestly a little disappointed that they could have made it this good the whole time and abundantly fucking did not.
Oh man, I'm so excited for
inevitable.
The breakdown. Because of course, like I've been watching AC as a franchise just like fumble the bag over and over again, and it's just like, come on, guys, you had a formula that worked. Why is it so hard now? And now it's like, they pulled it off. It's good again.
Like Adam and I had lunch yesterday, and we're like, this is good. Like we're not just going crazy. Like they're actually doing a lot of really interesting things with this. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah. I mean, it's not like there are things that I would like got quibbles with. I'm like, yeah, no, of course, me too. But like. Shit! So more to come on that in the coming months. I will be doing a realism review, which is exciting. That's been what I've been doing basically this whole weekend is just going through some of the new AC. I don't have the mental fortitude for long gameplay sessions as I used to. Hmm. I like in high school and early college, I could sit down for like 7 hours and just play. And now after 2.5, I'm like, yeah, I want to sit up and stretch. I'm like, no, you're weak, old man.
I picked up Detective Pikachu because I was like, well, I would kind of want to see how they've done this, giving him a human voice that kind of sounds like Will Arnett, but is not. It's fine. Get it on sale if you're going to play it. It's a cute game. It feels like getting hit by a truck every single time a Pokemon opens his mouth, and instead of like digital screeches coming out, it's just definitely a human woman talking. but there's not a lot of like gameplay to it so much. It's definitely I feel like maybe it's one of those times you play a game. I'm like, this is for kids. This is not for me.
Yeah. Is that why they're doing a Pokemon Go event and for Detective Pikachu this week?
Yes, it came out.
I didn't realize there was a new release. Okay, yeah.
That's why Pikachu's got that little hat on, little deerstalker.
The hat's pretty cute. They're also doing Slowpokes with a little hat. It took me a while before I was like, oh, it's Watson. I get it.
It's not, but he does. There is a Slowpoke with a hat in the game.
Watson.
I know.
You, the human, are kind of the Watson to Pikachu's Sherlock Holmes.
What's the purpose of the Slowpoke with the hat?
He's just another guy's friend who also wears a hat. He's like the friend of like a archaeology professor or something who wears a matching hat with him.
That makes less sense than my theory.
That makes less sense.
I was surprised how little... I understand this game is... my understanding is it's a sequel to the original from way back when. There's not as many mysteries to be solved as I thought there were. The second like chapter of the game is like, we just kind of have to get out of where we are. It's not really a mystery. It's just sort of like click.
On the subject of keeping things like kid friendly, what level of mystery are we talking about with a Detective Pikachu? Is he rolling up on a homicide case?
I think it'd be better if he was. No, so far it's been a theft. Someone was trapped in some ruins, and now Pikachu has been framed for property damage. And I imagine it'll continue in that sort of vein. The big climax of the last one is someone was like using mind control on Pokemon with like Mewtwo's blood or something like that.
Oh, so like the plot of Detective Pikachu, the movie that we all saw when it came out.
They referenced that in the game. They're like, we got so famous, they made a movie about us. And I'm like, in the movie, aren't you the real human boy's dad or something?
Yeah, you are real actual man, Ryan Reynolds, in the body of a Pikachu.
It kind of gives them, they kind of have the recurring twist of like, we don't know. We got to find his dad. I'm like, I'm pretty sure that Pikachu's your dad, but I haven't played through enough of this game to get confirmation of that yet.
I'm thinking with like the caliber of the mysteries and whether Detective Pikachu rolls up to a homicide. Like once again, this like super grizzled noir Detective Pikachu. Like, so I rolled into the joint and the dame's got legs up to here and blood up to everywhere else. Pika!
Oh my God.
What got me is that they do have a, like, after the first chapter, there is, like, a dream sequence Pikachu has where he, like, has a nightmare about the kid's dad leaving his wife and kids saying he wants a divorce, and the dad has the same voice as Detective Pikachu, and I'm like, I don't know, I think I see where this is going, but it feels like this is a crazy way to introduce this concept to me, the audience.
Especially, like, if all the other Pokemon can just talk.
Yeah.
And, like,
they just
this one's just a human man in a Pikachu.
Hey, Squirtle, can you just into this microphone say, I want a divorce? Okay, thank you. Not you.
The other Pokemon, like, they have humans making the sound of Pokemon like they do in, like, a lot of the anime episodes. But it was just fun to hear that in a video game because a lot of the times in the video game, they do, like, little digital beeps and stuff. And I think that works great. It helps make them seem like they're little guys. But, yeah, in this one, it is definitely just, like, a cadre of voice actors who are doing all of the Pokemon voices. And it's neat. But sometimes it just, like, is a man saying Squirtle, and you're like, oh, I have to live with this.
I'll see you all in the next episode on Friday, and excited for the next podcast.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right, guys.
Bye. All right. So,
Blue had to go like do an adult responsibility thing. So me and Red are bringing it home.
Yeah, I've been holding back on talking about like Twilight Zone and Star Trek the whole time because I feel so bad because like last time it was all Sailor Moon, a show that Blue has never watched and knows only what I've told him. And then like yesterday we were on a call with some friends and I was talking about some Twilight Zone with them. And I was like, okay, these guys have seen some Twilight Zone, but Blue hasn't. And like I had that like little like, uh-oh, someone's going a little glassy-eyed in chat. Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, it's interesting. It's really dense nerd homework in that, you know, you watch a single episode and you're like, oh, that inspired this or that inspired that or like that kicked off. Something about Twilight Zone doesn't invite imitation exactly, but it invites people to be like, I could do that. That it's so clean and simple. How hard could it be? And not a single one of them has ever pulled it off to my knowledge. It's like anytime I watch like a Black Mirror episode, I'm like, this is doing too much. Twilight Zone does like one thing per episode.
Yeah, I feel like the impulse with a lot of like later anthology series is less to focus on the anthology part of that and knowing that you can space out your content and more of being like, mm-hmm. well, the thing that people like about Twilight Zone was the twists, so we have to have a lot of those. And I feel like it's sort of a misunderstanding of what the series did really well, which was highlighting a lot of different smaller sci-fi and horror kind of like stories as opposed to having a particular story structure. I think a show that does a good job of having that sort of anthology is The X-Files, only because they have the two kinds of episodes. They have the like story episodes, they have the anthology episodes. And the anthology ones, I think, are a much better spiritual successor to The Twilight Zone than like your Black Mirrors, where it's almost more about the one core question and that question being expressed in a specific kind of story structure, which is something is clearly going to go wrong here. One person's realized something that's wrong, and now the episode will end and be a little spooky.
Yeah, I mean, like, the thing is, people think that The Twilight Zone highlights twists, but, like, I started compiling a little list of, like, The Twilight Zone twists, because there are not that many of them. That's the thing. Like, every episode has a twist, but a lot of the twists are the same, or at least fall into the same general structure. You basically got... you've got... Thought it was Earth, it wasn't. Thought it wasn't Earth, it was. Thought they were alive, they weren't. Thought they were in heaven, they weren't. That one, to my knowledge, has only happened once, but maybe it happens more. Person becomes obsessively unhinged about something. It might be supernatural. People might just be like that. What if time travel? Is magic real? The answer is yes, but you're going to wish it wasn't. Be careful what you wish for. And the one that I've just... codified most of them as is, would that be fucked up or what? Because that's the thing, like, most episodes of The Twilight Zone don't have a moral. It's just like, boy, that shit was pretty wild, am I right? That would be pretty fucked up. And, like, the twists, you know, sort of relate to that, but they aren't innately complicated. And I think that's the thing. There's this desire for convolution in writers that are trying to be inspired by The Twilight Zone. They're like, well, I just don't want to... Everyone can predict the, oh, it wasn't Earth thing. And it's like, you could predict that if you watched the episode of Twilight Zone. That's not what made the episode work. One of the pretty iconic thought it wasn't Earth, but it was, is one where these astronauts go up in a rocket, and they crash on this desolate, barren, like, desert rock, and they're like, oh, what are we going to do? One of them dies in the crash or shortly thereafter, and the team leader kind of tries to hold things together, but one of the astronauts just immediately goes like, we're going to die out here. We have to preserve our strength. You know, you're all wasting water. And he, like, kills one of the teammates when they're off, like, trying to explore to figure out, you know, where they are. Are there any resources they can use? And then he ends up shooting his captain. But the guy who he thought he killed had managed to survive long enough to, like, see something, and he draws it in the dirt before he passes. And then the guy, like, climbs up the hill that the guy indicated that he climbed up and sees that he's... He's 25 miles out from Reno. They crashed on Earth. he landed just in the Nevada desert. And... like, the thing is, you can watch that and be like, I don't think they're in space. This looks like Nevada. And, like, you can be like, well, you know, filming constraints, they probably had to film it in Nevada. But then you're like, no, hold on. I think maybe they're not anywhere in space. I think they're on Earth. But, like, does that help you? Does that make the astronaut not kill his team? Mm-hmm. No. Knowing the twist is coming makes it more harrowing, because you're like, maybe they can hold it together long enough to figure out that they're still on Earth. And the answer is no. It's a tragedy. You see this guy create his own undoing through his paranoia. And that's interesting and compelling. But I think if you just look at this from kind of like a surface perspective, you're like, it's about the twists. I must make twists that surpass the Twilight Zone twists. And then you get complicated shit like, oh, you thought you were living some kind of incomprehensible nightmare, but actually you are living an incomprehensible nightmare, but it's a prison punishment for you committing a horrible crime at some point. We gave you amnesia, and then we put you in an incomprehensible nightmare, and it's punishment for you having done a bad thing. And it's like, is that really that much more comprehensible than, oh boy, I hope that spooky man in the basement isn't the devil? He is. Anyway.
Yeah, I feel like there was something of, and it's still around to a point, but there was this like mid-2010s obsession with the twist and the idea of being like unpredictable in the media you're writing. Famously, Game of Thrones went too hard on this and it was just like a train wreck. And I think Black Mirror suffers from it to a lesser extent, but depending on the episode, but still, like, this obsession with we have to surprise the audience at all costs kind of loses visual on like what the actual impact of a twist can be, because a twist only works if you have been set up to expect something else, and the twist recontextualizes everything that came before it in a meaningful way, so that, you know, it's the Hitchcockian idea of like on a rewatch, you're still going to feel suspense now, because even though you know what's coming, what the twist is, you are able to see how the events unfold. Like you're saying, you still know the astronaut's gonna kill all of his crew members. Yeah. The dread of knowing that that's coming, the suspense of like, oh my god, can I figure out the twist by looking in the background? Like, can I see how they could have figured it out? There are ways to make media with a twitch be rewatchable and interesting still. But if your only focus is I have to put a twist into this, often can fail to consider how to do that effectively. And there was this like mid-2010s, a lot of pieces of media got really into this. And I think a lot of that came from the obsession with no spoilers. Like, no one can, don't spoil the movie. Yeah. Don't tell me what happened. And yeah, I'm glad that we're kind of it feels like we're on the downswing of that a little bit. I think people have gotten a little bit chiller about spoilers for stuff.
Fingers crossed, at least.
Yeah.
But like, I feel like at bare minimum, the fact that The Twilight Zone was such an iconic piece of media that it has inspired this much, you know, imitation, the episodes have gone down in history, and it is entirely based on set up one thing, twist, pay off another. And the fact that a show built on plot twists can have held up that long when every major episode's twist has been spoiled by pop culture osmosis means that by its very nature, it cannot be doing the surprise, no spoilers. Yeah. Just like, everyone knows how Time Enough at Last ends, even if they don't know that they know. Yeah. It's the one where he's like, oh, finally, I'll have a chance to read my book. Oh no, my glasses have been broken and it is the apocalypse and I am the last man alive, so nobody can fix my glasses. And like, people are like, it's like a karmic downfall, be careful what you wish for thing. And then you watch the episode and you're like, no, it's not. Would this be fucked up or what? This guy did nothing to deserve this. He's just a guy with attention regulation issues who wanted a nice quiet place to read and accidentally survived nuclear Armageddon, and then something bad happened to him. Would that be fucked up or what? And it's like, it's not about the twist being unpredictable. It's about the process being enjoyable. And like, and half of the irony is like, oh boy, I know what's going on here. I hope they figure it out in time. And some of the episodes they do, and some of them they don't. Mm-hmm. So like, astronaut guy didn't figure it out in time. But there was an episode that I caught like half of where this woman was having these like weird, slightly disconnected like experiences, like her memory wasn't working. And some of who she was talking to was this guy who was, you know, clean cut and seemed polite, but like slightly weird. And then a lot of them were these conversations with this little girl who seemed to know way too much about her. And I was like, no way in hell are the conversations with the little girl really happening. That little girl is definitely her, but I don't know about the guy. And it turned out, like, yeah, the little girl was her. She was basically unrepressing some memories. The guy had committed a crime that she had witnessed when she was the age of that little girl, and he had recognized her and was sort of feeling out to see if, like, she'd remembered that he had, like, killed her mother. And, you know, when you figure out, okay, the little girl is, like, a part of her psyche and is trying to get her out of this situation, you're like, I hope she figures that out before this guy fucking kills her. And then she does. And it's like, okay, phew. And then you get the astronaut thing. You're like, well, that guy sucked. I kind of wish he hadn't murdered all those people when he was just 25 miles out of Reno.
Ironically, that is the same reaction I have to the Darth Vader is Luke's dad twist every time. He's like, you mean this guy could have just not murdered all of the children and we would have been... You could have just figured this shit out. So many movies. Or, like, I guess more accurately, Darth Vader turning on Palpatine in the end there. But, like,
oh, yeah.
Come
yeah.
on.
He does. That one's kind of unfortunate because, like, you get the twist. Like, he figures it out. Or at least he, like, knows. From
yeah.
at least the jump in episode two, because Palpatine tells him, it's like, he's the child of Anakin Skywalker, and Darth Vader's like, why did you phrase it like that, my lord? Kind of yeah. weird. Nobody else is in this room.
But that's another, like, it's a good example of a very iconic movie twist that has not in any mm-hmm. way ruined watching the movie or its prequels, you know? It's,
no.
you know, people can talk about Star Wars all they want in whatever way they want, but the Darth Vader being Luke's father being a twist reveal is not something that, despite being more in the popular conscience than being surprising, has made mm-hmm. the franchise less enjoyable. That's the franchise's own fault for doing that with the sequel trilogy and beyond. But there's a time and a place for plot twists. I think they can be an incredibly effective tool, but it's frustrating to see people take the lessons of, like, the Twilight Zone that does them so successfully so frequently and kind of miss the point so bad.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, plot twists have a place, but the only thing that matters with a plot twist is that it confuses or surprises the characters. Mm-hmm. Like, the audience, if you make a story that has no rewatch value, it will have no rewatch value.
Yeah.
People aren't going to rewatch it. And, like, I think that's probably why that was such a short-lived craze in, like, the 2010s. Because I cottoned on to something that was related to that, which was... There was like a boom in the early 2010s of shows where, like, the selling point was, yeah, being the main character doesn't mean you're safe. Anyone can die. You got, mm-hmm. you know, like Game of Thrones and Walking Dead and Attack on Titan and just, like, from all these different directions you were getting, like, oh my gosh, anyone could die. And, like, that was the pitch, and it carried them through a few seasons of, like, oh my god, I can't believe they killed that guy. I thought he was so important. He had all these dangling plot threads that I was excited to see resolved, and then they just killed him, and why is this not making me feel good for some reason? Like, even those shows in the later seasons started using, you know, standard issue plot armor for the actual important characters, where it's like, look, I know we said anyone can die, but we do actually need Jon Snow for this next bit, so, like, he's coming back. Because that's the thing, like, the reason why stories are not typically built in a way where anyone can die is because if you randomly kill off a character that had a lot of the plot hooked into them, all those threads just drop and unravel, and, you know, maybe someone else can pick them up, but, like, it's a lot of work, and it's simply easier in a lot of cases to let the character play out their arc, tie off those threads, and then die, which is why you gotta watch out for any character. It's like, wow, finally, I'm at peace and for the first time and at last and 2 weeks from retirement and all that, you know, yeah. all that shit. But, like, it was such a, like, widespread selling point, and a lot of people were like, yeah, it's really fresh and exciting that I feel unsafe watching this show because the characters that I care about might just die and never come back. And it's like, that makes you feel good about this? You enjoy this process? And the thing is, yeah. I recognize that that does work for a lot of people. It's just, I think the reason why it turned out to be a thing they did in moderation, or, like, that lasted for the first few seasons and then sort of tapered off as the story got more cohesive. Like, killing off Ned Stark after one season, great. In the grand scheme of things, he's not that important. He would have solved a few things, but, like, you get rid of him, wow, I can't believe they killed the main guy, like, the most standard hero of the bunch. That's wild. Anyway, let's all pick up the pieces and move on. But, like, you know, if you're, like, in season 7 and you kill off the main guy and then you have to do the last season without the main guy, it's like, well, fuck, we were kind of relying on the main guy. He was pretty load-bearing at this point.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, Game of Thrones suffered from run out of pretty masterfully crafted books to base ourselves off of, and now we're just kind of flying blind. But I understand the, like, impulse of why an audience might be interested in the tagline of, like, it's anyone could die. It's not safe for anyone. Like, it may not be my personal favorite absolute subgenre tag, but it certainly has its merits. And I think that there was something to that with early Game of Thrones where, at least watching it, it never felt like literally anyone could die at any second for no reason. I think they do... George R.R. does a good job of, in his early books, crafting a story where, yes, important characters might die, but their deaths always have some sort of impact or feel like they are for a purpose, whether it is if they have fulfilled a purpose in the story or their death will have an incredible impact on another character and that character will be driven to do other things. And I would guess that inevitably by the time if he ever put out more books, that there would be characters who would have a degree of plot armor of, I've been through this much this long, it would take a lot for my death to have the kind of meaning that early season characters could get away with dying of. But yeah, like by the time we got to season 7 or 8, it just... all of that out the window. It became all about shock factor. And that's where it started to lose me. Because I think there is some merit to none of these characters are safe. And therefore, you can take some risks in the storytelling and put them in scenarios that other stories and characters couldn't be in because plot armor would demand that they find a way to succeed. And sometimes that success might feel a little bit of jumping the shark or a little bit like too... And then Eagle swooped down and picked them up and flew them away, which I love that. But still... I think it depends on the tone of the show or the book or the movie that you're going for.
Yeah. That's really it. It's a matter of tone. And but I do think that there was this odd little burst of obsession with, like, we have to keep the audience off balance. Mm-hmm. They've started to predict us. They've started to make Reddit threads of theories about us.
Well, I think that that gets to the kind of, like, mid-2010s obsession with, like, no spoilers allowed. It's like, we can't let anyone know what's going to happen until it happens. And part of that is maybe compensating for some weaker writing. Like, if they know what's going to happen, they're not going to enjoy the ride because it's all about that moment of surprise when the twist happens and not... there's no suspense behind it to follow up for the second viewing or, you know, if you got spoiled the first viewing. And it's rough. We are getting close to time. I know, because I know us as people, I know you and I could continue this conversation ad infinitum.
Yeah, a little bit. No, I mean, because we've found a thread of something very interesting obviously there are a ton of trends in the general pop cultural space of writing and showrunner writing and stuff like that. And the writer's strike really made me realize, like, a lot of the time it's just caused by outside factors. Like, why did everything start sucking in 2007? Oh, right.
It's amazing. But like, film and TV in particular, the industry pipeline is like, there's so many things that go into it. It's so, sometimes it is just bad writing, but a lot of the times something was going on.
Well, I mean, like, even just the very simple, like, we've got a thing planned for this character. Oh, the actor can no longer participate in the show. I guess
shout
we're
out
killing
the BBC
off this character.
For their, like, two-year contracts. I love Midsummer Murders. They go through so many deputies in that show.
Oh, gosh. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to unpack, but, like, you can also see these longer trends of, like, somebody started pushing for shock factor, subversion of expectations, subversion of tropes. Like, they've started to document tropes. We gotta get out from under this. We gotta do something new and fresh. And I feel like obviously that's a complete fallacy. Like, anyone who's, like, been the audience of a story for long enough has been like, look, I don't need constant innovation. I know what I like. I want more of it, you know? It's why so many people will just, like, go into a fanfic tag and be like, I will take 500 of your finest, please, and then I'll still be hungry for more. it's the two cakes school of creativity. But, like, when you're a creator, that's not how you feel. You want to do something new. Like, even if it's just a new version of an old story, you still want it to... I don't necessarily know if the drive for being original is innate in certain artists and not in others. I think most artists are like, there are things I want to create, or there are things I want to exist, or there are things I find beautiful, or some combination of those three, and it turns into something that they create. And as a result of who they are and what they've lived and what their skill set are, they create something that nobody else could have done. Just by their nature, just by trying to create something from the heart, what they create, the specific way it manifests, is completely original to them. But they don't see it that way, because in their head, it's like, well, I got this idea from this movie that I liked, and I got this idea from this epic cycle that I read, and I got this idea from this thing, and I put them together, and it turned into this. And from my perspective, it's just a kludged together Frankenstein of things that I liked that I wanted to put in it. And then from the perspective of somebody on the outside, it's like, this was exactly what I needed, or like, this was fun, and I liked it. You know, for some people, the art is life-changing. For other people, the art is pleasant and fun, and they just want to have a good time with it. And for some creators, they're like, I want to make something life-changing. And for some of them, it's like, I want to make something that's fun. I want to have fun with it, and I want people to have fun with it. And then sometimes it's like, I want to be original. And I feel like that is an artificial imposition on the creative process. I feel like people are told that they have to be original, and they get worried about it, and it just sits in their head and shapes the way they think about art. Because, you know, people will tell you, like, there's nothing new under the sun. You're going to do a thing and be like, oh, shit, that's a thing that you know, I did, basically. I thought I came up with that, but turns out they did it in a Star Trek episode 30 years ago. Well, fuck me, I guess.
I think it's more important to figure out, and this is the same advice I give people who want to start podcasts, is like, figure out what type of thing you want to make, whether it's type of story, type of show, type of whatever it is. Like, do you want to do fantasy? Great, do fantasy. Because coming, like you said, coming from you with all of your various influences and experiences in life, you'll make something that's different, that's new. Whether it's, you know, maybe it draws some sources from Lord of the Rings or from whoever, but it'll still have your own unique flair on it because it is you making it.
I saw a Tumblr post frame it like this, where it's like, a lot of artists want to get their art to the point where it no longer looks like they made it, and that is an impossible dream. You know, you're always going to create things that look like you made them just by the nature of how creativity works. But in your head, it's like, the thing that my fingerprints on this are the problems with it. And it's like, no, sorry. From an outside perspective, those are what makes it work.
I am forever cursed with eyes that look like they could be on an episode of Stormhawks. And that's just something I've accepted about my art at this point.
Oh my gosh, yeah. The funny thing is, like, I think a lot of people look at their art style and are like, it's not that distinctive, because I know that's how I felt. I did a Tears of the Kingdom comic with the long-term nuclear waste warning text, and it went a little bit viral on Tumblr, and there's a lot of people in the notes that are like, this art style looks really familiar, and I'm like, no, it doesn't, shut up, because it doesn't really look like what I draw in the videos. I'm like, hey, I'd like you to show me a single nose in that art style you're referencing, but it's like, I can't make my art look like I didn't draw it, you know? It's just, I'm so used to it that for me, it's just like, that's just how things look. What's going on?
We're pretty over time, and I've got Thai food on the way, so I think we do have to call it here, but I'm sure we will reopen similar discussions on future AISSs.
Absolutely. Negotiations will certainly proceed.
This has been an After Show Show. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another one of these, presumably.
All right, bye, everybody.